Honorable Member, let me welcome the Human Rights Commission delegation led by Mrs. Janet Love, accompanied by Commissioner Mohammed Shafi Amemia, Mrs. Yuri Ramkisun, Senior Researcher, Ms. Fedla Adams, Senior Researcher, Mrs. Rachel Watt, Private Researcher. Before we start, let me just say that we have challenges here because we have members of Parliament who have to catch connecting flights. So our Friday meetings are challenges that we are still addressing with the leadership of the institution, because we value your attendance, but to call you from Pretoria and then when you arrive here and then we are on our way out, it's also not right. But that's a situation beyond the control of the members. You will bear with us if we try to rush you. But this is not the beginning and the end. We shall be interacting going forward. But let me say that we received your presentation and went through it. It's quite detailed, but I don't think that we should really expect you to give all the details, because we expect members of Parliament to be familiar with the Commission and its mandate. But I think there are matters that need attention, and if we can focus on those matters that need attention, because your chairperson has also written to me saying that preferably you would have loved a situation where all the ISDs meet together, we engage, rather than request written submissions. And the reason we opted for that route is because during the budget hearings, there was also not sufficient time for the ISDs to present, so we requested that additional information should be presented in the form of submissions. And also there was concern that their initial request for the meeting was really briefings but on duplications, but apparently the committee extended the mandate. And we did so consciously because we think that the matters between Parliament and the ISDs did not receive sufficient attention during the past 15 years. And during this term of Parliament, we really want to rectify what has not gone right before. So I want to then ask Ms. Janet Love to lead us in the presentation. But as you present, let me just say to you, I saw that lots of work was done with regard to the international UN instrument, but very little on the African instrument, so that if you can address that issue and tell us what your intentions are.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. I will come back to that issue that you've just raised, but I do want to take members through this presentation quite quickly, mindful of your time. So, first of all, the outline of the presentation is as you see it. And if there are things that pages or parts of this presentation you want me to stop, I'll do that. But otherwise, I'm going full steam ahead. The South African Human Rights Commission has got certain monitoring obligations, And you, as the chairperson has said, are familiar with that. The one thing you may not be familiar with, and I believe that we might have to have a conversation about what this means, is what the Paris principles are all about, and therefore what makes the South African Human Rights Commission recognized as a human rights institution that qualifies in the sense that it complies with these principles. That's quite an important issue, because otherwise the monitoring opportunities and the opportunities to speak at the Human Rights Council would not exist. On a broad level, with regard to international obligations, as well as dealing with those things domestically, and I'm referring here not just to the UN level but also the African level, we do a number of things, and we've identified some issues here. On a specific level, we deal with particular treaties, and we've mentioned some treaties, but not all the treaties. You'll see in that list on the slide that is showing at the moment, there are five treaty bodies that are mentioned. Clearly, there are other treaty bodies. All in all, there are nine treaty bodies. In addition to that, there are a certain number of structures that support treaty bodies, for example, the Human Rights Committee and its interaction with the Committee on Civil and Political Rights. So again, I'm happy to talk to any of these things here, including what specific level engagements we have, but for now I'm going to pass on, and people will come back to this if they find that there are questions that they have, including issues of abbreviations. Okay, so the importance of our engagement, we have to, I suppose, as a country, question what the importance of our obligation as South Africa, our involvement, rather, as South Africa in international engagements. And there are many, but in the realm of human rights in particular, I think our engagement is not only to demonstrate a commitment and to reflect on how far we've gone, but hopefully I believe that there's a lot that we can learn from others. There's a lot that we can gain from others, both in the form of technical assistance, but also in the form of exchange. If we then move on to the role of committees like this, we then have to go, starting off with the issue of the Constitution, to actually indicate exactly how this committee has got a very, very direct role. First of all, a state can be represented in Geneva, in New York, and a state can have its representative make a statement in support of any international agreement. But until that agreement is actually passing through various other processes, but in particular processes that involve the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, there is no possibility for that agreement to be binding. The only way it is binding is if this institution, the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, actually agree to the fact that it needs to be ratified, and thereafter there has to be various processes, including the domestication of legislation. So your role is critical. Once an agreement has become binding, obviously there are certain obligations. So if you have endorsed the fact that we sign a particular protocol, we sign a particular convention, part of what you're doing is you're endorsing the fact that government has committed itself to certain obligations, and in particular, those obligations deal not just with domesticating law and making sure that the practice that we have in South Africa complies, but also to ensure that the way in which we report on those obligations is in line with what our commitments are. So your parliamentary oversight, I would imagine, in addition to considering the wisdom of ratification of certain conventions and treaties, your obligations surely would be to increase awareness, not just amongst yourselves and colleagues, but in general within your work and your constituencies, to ensure that where there is a need for, where we have not yet as a country ratified certain international obligations, which you see our country as actually leading the way if we think about our constitution and our practice, let alone our constitution, it would be important for you to accelerate and encourage the process of ratification. Thereafter, there is the issue of monitoring, which is part of your function in any event, and ensuring that relevant departments are called to account where necessary and that any new legislation is in line with international law. We should also remember that our constitution itself requires the courts to take into account international law when interpreting legislation. So briefly then, to look at the United Nations system and where some of these treaties and conventions fall. As you all know, the United Nations system is only one component of the international system. We've got our regional instruments, which I'm going to come to. We've also got sub-regional instruments in the form of SADC. And then there are other organizations that are not strictly part of the United Nations system, but of which South Africa is a fully-fledged member and part. Just by way of example, the World Trade Organization. Okay, so let's look then at what we have in terms of the international instruments. International instruments in the form of declarations, proclamations, statements in various assemblies, and participation in the drawing up as well as the implementation of programs of action are all politically binding. So if we have a representative who goes and makes a statement in New York, in Geneva, next week in Addis Ababa, that statement is regarded as a politically binding declaration. Clearly, legally binding instruments have to be going through different kinds of bars and standards. You can't have something that will be legally binding, which in our constitution has not been served before yourselves, because you are our legislature, you are our elected representatives. We've got the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as our founding document, and within that we've got what's called the charter system and the treaty body system. And I think this is quite an important distinction. It's not just a distinction that exists within the UN system, it's a distinction that exists also within the African system. And the distinction is those structures of these institutions which are structures that are composed of state representatives. So in other words, our commission, our sub-commissions, our working groups, there are state representatives who have got mandates to actually be acting in an independent capacity but have a level of accountability to their state. We've got the treaty body system, which is very consciously, although the people who serve on these treaty bodies are elected by state parties, the treaty bodies are composed of people who have expertise. That is the reason that they are there. They are independent experts. In some treaty bodies, there is actually a requirement that a person may not be removed from that treaty body unless he or she agrees in order to really insulate the experts who serve on those committees from political pressure, because what the United Nations wants is expertise in order to inform them about performance, in order to inform them of challenges, and in order in those cases where there are instruments that deal with inquiries to conduct inquiries and take individual complaints. So how do we domesticate a treaty? We domesticate a treaty with signature, with ratification, which, as I indicated, was something that you are required in terms of South African law to be a part of. We then have to make sure that our legislation is compliant, and where we don't have legislation, we make sure that we create the legislation, again, where you come into play, and also that we have implementation in practice, which you would oversee. We've got in our presentation, and I won't go through each one, but I'm happy to answer questions on any of them, the way some of these functions of the treaty bodies operate. This is just by way of background information. We've identified here the cycle. It's an ongoing cycle. You have a state submitting a report, Some treaty bodies require it every 2 years. Some treaty bodies every 4 years, etc., etc. It submits a report. The treaty body asks questions. States have to submit responses. Thereafter, there is a finalization of the submission, and the treaty body makes concluding observations, and then there are recommendations for follow-up. And the next report has to address those follow-up. It's just like an audit process in that sense, that there's an expectation that there will be corrective interventions, and that would indeed be what you would be monitoring. You've got informal report mechanisms, you've got opportunities in terms of questions, concerns, and even in the drawing up of reports, there should be opportunities created for civil society organizations, for national human rights institutions like ourselves to make some inputs formally into the report that is lodged. That doesn't prevent them, once a report is lodged, from in addition putting forward concerns and questions because they don't agree with something or they think the report has shortcomings in certain ways. But the idea is that states should try and make their reports as comprehensive as possible. And this overview of treaties that we've included here goes through, very broadly speaking, what the primary content of the treaty is itself. Now, one of the things that I wanted just in this, because I'm certainly not going to take up your time going through this in detail, is to highlight for you something I'm going to come back to presently. And that is the fact that when you look at the treaty, the content of treaties, it becomes very clear. There are firstly overlaps, and there are secondly cross-cutting issues. And that's relevant, and I'm going to explain how in a moment, when it comes to issues of reporting and oversight. We've got a number of conventions that, as you can imagine, South Africa has had huge impact and input into. So it's not, these are treaty bodies that we can really feel and take ownership of. These two in particular, in terms of racial discrimination and women, and so on and so forth. I just wanted again to mention something about optional protocols. You will have a treaty, for example, the Convention Against, or the Committee Against Torture and its convention, but you will then also have a separate document called an optional protocol. Now, what happens is you'll get a situation where that original convention is put before governments, in eventually put before the legislature, and so on and so forth, and it is ratified, it is domesticated, and so on. But then there will be an additional aspect which various state parties think is critical. So, for example, in the case of the Convention Against Torture, one of the things that various parties felt was critical in this regard was to actually formally set up a mechanism for prevention. You've got other optional protocols that, for example, with regard to the economic, social, and cultural rights framework, where the optional protocol is to enable people to lodge complaints, to enable the committee to carry out inquiries. So optional protocols, although they are associated with a primary document, are agreed to separately and have to be thought about separately by yourselves and others, as well as being reported on separately. Okay, let's look at what we have ratified and what we haven't ratified. So at this stage, and I'll come back to some of these where it says not ratified, we've ratified the civil and political rights one. We've ratified the elimination of racial discrimination, elimination of discrimination against women, the Convention Against Torture, rights of the child, the issues is supporting, protecting, and promoting dignity of persons with disabilities. Those we have ratified. What we haven't ratified, starting from the bottom, is the enforced disappearance convention. That is new. It's a new convention. So that is something that has not really served, even within the international community, in its finalized form. Secondly, migrant workers. There again, we have, as you know, a very long-standing relationship as a country with the International Labour Organization. And many of the issues that deal with migrant workers are dealt with through our involvement there. In addition to that, this particular migrant worker convention deals with migrant workers who come and work in one country that they are not national citizens of. So it does not deal with all issues to do with migrant workers. For example, internal migration. And internal migration in some countries is a very, very charged issue, such as a country like China, where you've got the possibility of internal migration being very, very strictly controlled because of the huge and overwhelming pressure of urbanization that is a worldwide phenomenon. You've then got the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture, which, as I indicated, is separate to the convention itself. We have not ratified that. And then we have not ratified the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. I'm going to come back to those because I'm going to deal with them in reporting and deal with some of the issues that present challenges, but I did want to come to the African human rights system. First of all, I'm not going to go through again all these slides about the African Union, but I think that there are two very critical issues that we do need to recognize. The African Union established the human rights instrument, or the Commission for the Advancement of Human and People's Rights, under the previous African Union. So this African Union that we have, that was officially launched in 2002 with its new structures, took on board a commission that at that time had really been almost dormant. So what we're talking about is an instrument that is, a set of instruments, a set of mechanisms that is really extremely young. The second thing is that for these instruments to actually be able to work and to function, it becomes very clear that you need to have people who drive them, people who are appointed by states as representatives of states, and also experts. Now, the African Commission on People and Human Rights has not developed many working groups. It has got some working groups, and it certainly hasn't developed many instruments of experts, although there are some, and I will mention those in due course. So this goes into the fact that we do have the charter, the Banjul Charter, we have the protocol on women, we have the protocol on children, and we have the subsequent protocol on the African Court. And I think you may know, but there is a discussion that we should probably engage with you around in relation to the African Court, because there are various discussions that are at play at the moment at the level of the African Union about what the area of responsibility of this court should be, and also the way in which this court functions. The one thing I want to say about this court is that at the moment, the court is able to receive complaints by state parties, by all state parties who are signatories. It cannot receive complaints by any non-state party unless a state writes an official letter to confirm that it is comfortable to be able to have that happen. Now, both our president and our government have assured the Human Rights Commission, as well as the court, that South Africa is in support of this, because otherwise there is clearly a very limited role that the court can play, and that's said by our own judge who went to the African Court, as well as the other judges. But up until now, that letter has still not been signed. So again, the extent to which we can use some of these instruments, are relatively limited at this stage until we do the compliance. We've got here a little bit more detail about each of the existing instruments. The one working group, we haven't in either the United Nations system or in the African system mentioned in this presentation which working groups exist and which have been created. What I would say is that the Human Rights Commission, the South African Human Rights Commission, has worked very closely with the Children's Protocol here and the committee that deals with it. And we also, 2 weeks ago, hosted the regional consultation of the Working Group on Extractive Industries, which is having 5 sub-regional consultations within Africa. We hosted the one that was on that involved Southern African countries, and that working group is going on to proceed with its other consultations. So there is work with the working groups, but it is, as I say, much less developed within the African system. Okay, here's just a graphic representation of linkage. Basically, any directives that come from international or regional and go back to international or regional. It's not you start international and then regional and then national. This picture is saying international and regional are on a par, right? There's no, you know, there's no hierarchy. A national government is the one that champions its relationships both with regions and national. Okay. Basically, there, what I've done is just simply put up there, as you have it on your slides, some of the issues that speak to what I've just said. Now let's look at a critical issue here, and that is our reporting record. Okay, I'm going to start when I talk about reporting by making a couple of things clear. First of all, you, I'm sure, as a committee, given what your chairperson has said, will be following up on these reports, because the report card as it stands at the moment is not a very good one. Okay, our reporting record is not very good. So what I wanted to raise here is to give members of this committee an understanding that reporting is not a simple matter. It's not kind of, you know, you fill in some small form and it's, you know, done in a jiffy. It is complicated. We want you to know the complications so that when we tell you that things have not been done and you call the relevant department and they tell you the complications, you shouldn't be hearing them for the first time. You should know that we have all thought about the complications, as should they. Okay, so what are the complications? The first one starts with the responsible department. You take a covenant, like a covenant on civil and political rights, it's clearly hugely cross-cutting. Which department is going to be the responsible department? I mean, are we saying, for example, that in the Department of Mineral Resources, there's no civil or political rights that are affected? Let's think about Marikana, okay? Are we saying that in the Department of Police, that's where all civil and political rights are affected, clearly. So the point that I'm making here, and I don't want to belabor it, is it's a cross-cutting issue. So selecting the responsible department is critical, but it's also something that not necessarily every department is going to be in a queue to do. Right? Why? You all know to get 2 reports from 2 different departments where they have to give it to you separately is a hell of a lot easier than to get 1 report from the same 2 departments working together. And how much more if you're talking 40 departments? So there's not a queue to be the responsible department, and when the department is identified, you know that department can either be a super department or accused of being a super department, or accused of being a nanny, or feel like it's a nanny, okay? So I'm trying to say to you, this is already point number 1, where we have a difficulty. Point number 2, you then say departments must give inputs. Well, you know that giving inputs by different departments means that firstly those departments have to be collecting their stats. Secondly, the stats that one department has to collect has to speak to the stats that the other department has to collect. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to make sense of your report. We know now that we have within the presidency the possibility of monitoring in a much more effective way. But that is something that's firstly quite recent and has some ways to go. Okay, reporting cycles, I've mentioned the question of the reporting date. Now let's look at the consultation process. Again, it's not easy. Eventually, the super department, nanny department, responsible department, it depends which description you want to use, pulls together a report. And once it's pulled together that report has to go to the cluster. The cluster has to go through it. It's not a two-page report. It can sometimes be a 50-page report. The cluster has to be sure that the revisions that it's concerned about are put in. And it's not people sitting at that meeting. They're going to call this the director of this, the deputy director of that, etc., etc., to put in the additional information. Then they send it to Cabinet. Cabinet itself has got to consider it, also to require revisions. Only then is it finalized. And then it goes to our Department of International Relations for submission. Now, you might think that this is a straightforward, here is the, you know, document, and then they go to the... No, it's not like that. So there again lies some problems. Let us now go to the question of the reports. Okay, we have got a situation where on the civil and political rights, you see there's supposed to be a report cycle every year, and we are still due to give our, read it, initial report. Initial. So we've been a government that has been in place for, you know, quite a considerable amount of time, at least five reports later, maybe four, we haven't put in the initial report. Okay, let's do the next one. Strange there. Overdue. And what do we see? Every 2 years. We are in the process at the moment of putting together the second to the sixth report. Right? Again, problems. Now, I'm wanting to point these problems out, but I'm equally wanting to acknowledge the fact that in the last 3 years, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development now, I'm going to get confused with the names, but now you know Justice and Correctional Services, right? But in the last 3 years, huge progress has been made. So let's not knock it. I think there's real progress that has been made. But we are in deficit. And if this committee does not assist us in bringing ourselves up to speed, all the work that that department has done will not succeed to bring us the kind of result and to put us in the kind of sphere of compliance that we're clearly striving to get to. Again, convention. Now, I'm talking about conventions, as I said to you at the beginning, that are not conventions that some person imposed on us. These are conventions we, as South Africa, have played in the drafting of the conventions, the leading role. But in the implementation of the conventions, we play the leading role. I mean, some of the things that we do in South Africa, you know, as a commissioner on the Human Rights Commission, we do criticize, but we should equally embrace where we've made huge strides. Some of the things we take for granted in South Africa, countries that are supposed to be long-standing democracies, have just woken up to, whether it's the United States or countries in Europe. So it's not about stuff that's imposed on us. Convention Against Torture, overdue. Okay? Now we come to Convention on the Rights of the Child. As I said to you, report submitted to DIRCO for depositing with treaty bodies. Right? Now I know, you know, that there are some levels of complexity about the timing of that and when it is done. But there's also a problem about the fact that it becomes too much of a delay. By the time this gets deposited, we'll be due for the next one. Okay, convention again, it's now, and again, I wanted to make a note of the fact that it's not just the Department of Constitutional Development and Justice, or sorry, Justice and Correctional Services. Also, the Department of Social Development has done a huge amount of work in ensuring that reports are pulled together, and it needs to be said that this department has also played a huge role in having much broader consultations in order to get those reports there. Okay, this is one of the ones in terms of the African Charter. I mentioned to you that we very, very strongly participating both in this one and in relation to children, and yet, again, we're still waiting for reports to be submitted. Okay, so these are just questions of feedback and so on. I just want to, I haven't gone into all of the detail, but what you'll see here, so that's why I'm going back, is that there's some target dates that have come and gone, right? The point is that this is a target date that is still standing in our report to you, because notwithstanding the fact that we do have regular interactions with DIRCO, we haven't yet got new target dates for any of these, but you can see that all of these are supposed to be in the pipeline. Now we come to the issue of the International Covenant on Social and Cultural Rights, and we are really concerned about the fact that this is something that even though you yourselves have ratified this and the optional protocol on this particular convention, it is still not getting through the processes of government to be lodged. Now, this is an example of the problem being an absence of the department that is responsible. And what we are saying as a commission is we don't mind who's responsible, but because you can't find or make a final decision about who's responsible, we who are by far and above, you know, most of the countries who are signatories and who have got full marks for their reporting, in practice, doing more, much more actively, and yet we're in deficit. And you and your decisions as this committee are not implemented. And then we go through again some other things over here. Then we come to the issue of gender rights. Now, as this is an example of where there are parts of this globe that claim to be the leaders in various human rights initiatives that are really, just have discovered certain rights. These are the rights that they've recently discovered and now feel that they've got the sort of, the final say over them. I think that in South Africa, we are very mindful about the importance of gender-based rights, and because of that, our Minister of International Relations confirmed in 2014 in March the fact that this country would be hosting the regional consultation in the continent around issues to do with gender rights. Now, I don't think that commitment was made lightly. It was made at first in 2011. It's been confirmed in various ways, informally and formally, and as I say, it was now made in a very formal statement. The end of the period for regional consultations is very, very soon. We're literally weeks away. We are the only region, notwithstanding the fact that we are the region that is clearest about these issues in practice as well as in law. We are the only region that hasn't had the consultation. Now, what are the reasons? Well, we're told that there is a problem of money, but then we're told that there are departments that are willing to put the money up from their own budget. So it's not even that we have to go elsewhere. Okay? Secondly, there is an issue. Is the wisest place to have this consultation here? Maybe, maybe not. But there are other parts of Africa where it could be held and maybe should be held, because it would make people's minds a little bit more focused. Here's the difficulty. We've made a statement, we've made a commitment, we're not fulfilling it, we're simply repeating that we still remain committed, and yet when the crunch comes, we will be in deficit. Okay, what's the conclusion? I mean, the conclusion, I think, from the Human Rights Commission is we believe that over the last few years, as I say, with particular departments really playing a lead role, the Department of Justice, the Department of Social Services, I think we have done we've invested a huge amount of energy in getting our record, insofar as our reporting record is concerned, on the right path, a huge amount of energy. This committee really needs to assist both the people who've invested that energy as well as the Human Rights Commission to ensure that we take this forward. And so, I mean, that's why, even though some of us who've been here in this place before know what it's like to come here on a Friday and what your travel requirements are, we decided we have to come because we want you to be on board, we want you to understand, and there are a huge number of details. We've got them. If you have questions, please feel free to ask. Thank you, Chairperson.
Ms. Janet Ladd, thank you very much. I can see that you have really worked hard and you know where you should be going and what the challenges are, and that will be helpful to us. But I just want to say that you are raising a challenge of collaboration between departments, and therefore it's important to recognize that the Department of Social Development is here, represented by Mr. Zale Dengo, is over there, and then the Department of Justice is here, represented by Mr. Blendon Williams, so which means that departments are willing and able, maybe someone somewhere needs to coordinate and ensure that people don't come together by accident. But before I open up for the discussion, let me just make the following observation. I read a document, maybe I don't recall the details quite clearly, which indicate that awareness of the human rights culture or even the constitution in this country is very low. It's less than 50%. And now, if that is the question, the situation, the question would be, what is it that the Human Rights Commission, in terms of its mandate to promote and protect human rights, what is it doing concretely on the ground? What mechanisms are there on the ground to do that? And an associated question would be, to what extent do you use, for instance, advice centers and paralegals to promote awareness within communities? Because I think it would not help us to comply with the UN obligations, African Union obligations, SADC obligations, when our people know nothing about all those things. But another thing that I think we really need to look at is the fact that there is too much emphasis of on human rights, and human rights are individual rights. But communities, Africa talks about human and people's rights. During apartheid, if you talk about people's rights, people would say you are talking communism. But this is part of the African instrument. So I think that the Human Rights Commission should unpack what is the meaning of people, because that is important in the sense that if you have individual and people's rights, and you overemphasize individual rights at the expense of people's rights, what are the implications? Because the people constitute the national state as well. The other question is, I think there's a weakness. of relationship with Parliament. Since I came here in 2009, I have never seen a report from the Human Rights Commission submitted to Parliament, or any report. Because if Parliament, if reports are submitted to the office dealing with ISDs, and they don't reach the committees, we won't do what you are suggesting we should be doing. So I think we must accept that we have not been doing anything because nothing has come to us, which means there's a need for a dynamic relationship between the commissions and ourselves. But also the question of non-performance by the responsible department, especially on reporting to the UN, unless those difficulties are brought to our attention, we are not able to call the departments responsible to come and account why they are not doing their work. So I think we also need your assistance. If we get your reports and then we get the challenges, then we can call those departments to come and explain to us why things are not happening. Also, questions of ratification, domestication of these instruments. Unless we are aware of those instruments and the need, we are not able to act on that. There's also the question that your commission is the only one that has a speaking rights at the UN level, and the others don't, which should suggest that there should be some kind of coordination between yourselves so that those other bodies talk to you, so that when you talk at the UN level, you are actually representing all of them and therefore representing the country. Maybe that needs to be discussed and a way should be worked out. And the question of overlaps that you referred to, if you look at UN instruments, they will talk about children, they will talk about the right of association, freedom, religion, and so on. Then we have the Commission on Religious and Cultural Affairs. How do you relate with them in terms of addressing those issues? So that's something that we'd want to look at. But otherwise, I think that what is really urgent that we need really to consider is how we can, as South Africa, strengthen the usage of the African instruments, because we have the Pan-African Parliament here, and this parliament is represented there. So the challenges that you have, if they are brought to our attention, we can instruct our representatives in that forum to deal with those matters. But I think, members, as we discuss, I think we really need to identify the things that are urgent that we must do, and also unblock this reporting system to the UN, call the necessary department that is responsible to come before us and then explain why. And we have also the Department of International Relations. We can bring that department. We bring DIRCO, and we bring ourselves. We could even have a workshop on these things and really come out with a way forward and bring in the responsible cabinet minister so that we do this. We can't be signing documents for 20 years and nothing is happening. Our people know nothing about the documents that we are signing. It's really not on. So we are making our own constitution useless ourselves, and that has to stop urgently. Thank you very much, Honorable Horn. I can see that you really want to move in and take too much of your time.
Thank you, Chair. Is this on? Doesn't matter. Thank you. I think much of what you said during the beginning of your observations maybe must be on the agenda for another day. I think for today we must maybe keep our eye on the ball we're playing with today. And I think your concluding remarks is very relevant in the sense that I think what we as a committee now should do is to try and expedite the filing of those reports that are in the pipeline and see how we can assist to speed up that process. And I think, Chair, what we should also as a committee try and do is to see why this regional consultation in Africa, which our government has given an undertaking to arrange in 2011 already, has not taken place. In that regard, maybe if we can be assisted to just hear when the final cut-off date or due date for those reports are, and I think then we as a committee should maybe take it upon ourselves to write to the relevant ministers or maybe to ask them to come to us to explain why they have not arranged this meeting as promised in 2011 already. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and to thank the presentation and the work that you're doing in terms of helping South Africa to comply with international requirements for protection of human rights. But then the one thing that I want to comment on is that us being in Africa is also important for us to put a lot of effort into really looking at regional activities and Southern African developing communities activities, because you haven't actually mentioned the kind of protocols that SADC has got, which I think is very important for us. And it's not only important for South Africa, it's important for Southern African developing communities, those states around South Africa, because as we advance and develop, be it economically or in terms of human rights, we need to grow with our neighbors. And in that way, it will actually help to promote peace, because all of these instruments are actually dealt with because of the fact that we want to actually continue to promote peace in terms of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But at the same time, I think as we continue to ratify these instruments, we need to actually try to make sense as to what extent they actually put value to South Africa. I would be worried if we are a country that is ahead of almost all the countries of the world in terms of ratification of these instruments. But you look at South Africa and what is happening today, and you realize that there's strife. We have protests. And, of course, the Constitution of South Africa does allow protests to take place. But you look at the confusion that is around us in terms of culture of entitlement. Is it connected to people thinking or maybe being confused by access to rights? Because also rights have to be looked at and discussed in the context of also taking into consideration affordability by the country. Our people have actually come to a situation where they think that government must do everything for them. And I'm sure there's no other government in the world that gives more than South Africa. We give and we give. And I think it's because of the history that we come from. Our people have been denied so much that we have given. But in the process of giving, we're actually building a safety net in terms of ensuring that our people actually access these basic socio-economic rights. But at the same time, we should actually avoid rights, responsibilities being superseded by rights. Because then you create a situation that is problematic. Because all of this we actually do in order for us to be in the position to run a country that has got peace, which is a country that will actually be a caring place, a caring society, a better place to live in for everybody. So that's the area that I want you as a South African Human Rights Commission to look at and actually ask yourself a question as to how you actually see yourselves as players in this kind of arena. Because when you talk about governance, you are part of governance as Chapter 9 institutions. And if there's got to be peace and order in South Africa, Chapter 9 institutions have got a big role to play. And then in terms of reporting mechanisms, you've actually indicated the steps that are actually taken and what are the concerns. And to some extent, you're actually saying it's a mammoth task. We need a super department to be in the position to do it. But my take is that it's very important for us to understand the importance of consultation. You have to understand an instrument and who it affects, with whether it's within government departments or outside, because also consultation should go beyond government departments. It must actually also take into consideration civil society. And we want civil society also to participate so that by the time we take a report to the United Nations, it's a report that is owned by South Africans. And then you don't actually get the kind of confusion that we sometimes are told of, where you find that there's so many reports that are actually submitted to United Nations that come from South Africa. South Africans must actually have consultative meetings here at home, engage on these reports. And of course, if we don't agree, we understand there will be shadow reports. But the point I'm coming back to is consultation. And I guess it should be our responsibility to understand the kind of consultative mechanism that we need to build up in order for us to have a process that will have ownership at the end of the day in a way that actually allows us as a country to have a coordinated effort in terms of dealing with these instruments. And when it comes to the African Court itself, I'm sure you know already of Africa's sentiment about the International Criminal Court of Justice. And one wonders, to what extent are we actually looking at how to alleviate such concerns, looking at our use of our own African Court on Human and People's Rights? Is the court operating? Is it making any impact? Why our leaders are tried somewhere else? Why aren't they tried in Africa? Those are some of the questions that maybe we need to start asking ourselves, because we already have systems and mechanisms that can actually deal with the problems of Africa. But at the same time, I think it's not just about having all of these instruments. It's about really looking at affordability. Just now your concern, your main concern is, are we going to ratify the Convention on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights? And what is also important is to look at the financial implication that carries for the country, so that we don't set ourselves up for failure. Because if we are going to continue to ratify, we enter into the ratification process without really assessing affordability, we will ratify and we will fail. If you just think of the Grootboom case, remember it was actually connected to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, where government was actually taken to court in order for government to be forced to provide the right to shelter to the Grootboom children. But the fact of the matter is, and it can actually go and be beyond just for that one family, because indeed what we have actually committed ourselves to as government is that we will provide shelter for children of South Africa. And if you understand the implication, then you'd understand how careful we have to be when we ratify these instruments. And I think we should actually not take it that if I'm in the South African Human Rights Commission and I'm a Chapter 9 institution, my responsibility is just ratification. You don't look at the bigger picture, what it means for the country, because that is very important. And this is why countries like America actually took so long even to think of ratifying this instrument, because they understand the implication. And we have ratified. We are over-enthusiastic. And it's because of the history we come from that actually makes us to be so enthusiastic. So basically, I think the work that you're doing is good, but we need to put it in context to actually manage to promote peace and order in South Africa. Otherwise, we can continue to do such work and find that in the long run, it's work that actually becomes part of what creates instability in the country. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Manjaki. Any other? Maybe let's first hear the members. Mr. Dango and Mr. Williams, you are free to express yourself. If you, maybe I should give you a chance to say something before the response.
Thank you, Chair. I think there's not much for us to say. I think suffice the fact that I think we need the workshop to really go into the depth of the kind of discussions that we've had, and some of the issues we must address aside from the deficits in our depositing of reports and coordination around those kind of issues is also to get Parliament to also pronounce itself on what is the stance South Africa sees itself taking, what's the character we'd like to portray ourselves, both on the African continent and beyond. you know, our constitution is way beyond any of the treaty issues that have been put up. So whether we ratify a document doesn't really make a difference internally because we're one of the few countries, for example, that have made socioeconomic rights justiciable. So a lot of the litigation is based on our own constitution. I think what we need to look at is how do we want to ratify things where we actually look at what is the stance about the kind of rights framework we see for our own citizens, and how do we see that as being what we advocate for on the region and internationally. I think that's a very important question because I don't think we've within government itself, there's no common stance, and whether there's a common stance within South African society is something we need to debate. For example, the kind of issues that Ms. Love pointed out around gender rights, I think there's varying ways in which we are approaching that as government, and I think we need to come to a sort of more common approach to that. But looking forward to the workshop, Chair, I think that's going to be very important. I think it's going to allow us to do our work a lot better.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. You know, I think I'm in agreement 100%. I think Mr. Commissioner Janet Love has summed it up correct to say that in the past 2 or 3 years, I think government, especially the Department of Justice and Social Development, we've made huge progress. But at the same time, there's a sense of frustration in taking lots of issues and lots of reports that's been dealt with already by departments, that's been dealt with by cabinet, to take that forward and to have it deposited and to have the instruments ratified. So I think when the Chair of correctly have mentioned that when we can have this workshop where all the departments are present and explain the different positions, I think that will be a process and also some guidance from Parliament in taking that process forward, Commissioner.
Thank you very much. I think I would allow Ms. Janet, colleagues, to express yourself on the issues raised.
Thanks very much, Chair. So first of all, I'm going to try and work through the different questions that have been raised by yourself and other honourable members. I would, however, like as well, from the perspective of the Commission, like to endorse the idea of a workshop. I think that's a great idea because I think that there are lots of issues. As Honourable Member Majake mentioned, there's the whole question of the Southern African protocols, agreements and processes that isn't covered here, and one could go really through many such examples of things that we should be saying quite a lot more about. So the workshop is a great idea. With regard to the question that you raised, Chair, and it does link to some of the comments that were made subsequently, regarding the idea of the human rights obligations, responsibilities of everybody, including the Commission within South Africa, and then the obligations in terms of various conventions and protocols that may be to regional or international bodies. I think what's important here is what the person, you know, from what Mr. Dango said, is that the idea of having two sets of obligations is clearly not the idea at all. The idea is that any obligation one accedes to in an international, in a regional, in a sub-regional sphere is an obligation that one accedes to because it is regarded either as already part and parcel of what is our own domestic law or what we believe ought to be part and parcel of our domestic law. So our compliance obligations are not in terms of what is imposed on us from outside. Our compliance obligations are what's imposed on us from our own domestic legislation. So if you take, for example, the issue of the Convention on Civil and Political Rights or the Convention on Social and Economic Rights, it is true that there are various countries who place themselves in the front of the queue in their own view about being the standard bearers of human rights. But in fact, their domestic legislation falls short of our domestic legislation, which is why they find it difficult to ratify these conventions, but we should not, because our own legislation in our own country requires of us already probably in excess of what any of these conventions require. So I think that it's really important in that sense for that to be understood, that we would never, as the Human Rights Commission, be promoting something that is acceding to something that we do not believe is either already part and parcel of our existing legal framework or at least informs the policy on the basis of which new legislation would presumably be crafted. I think the second issue is then to look at this question you raised about the issues to do with individual and community rights. Well, we do actually engage very much within the framework, both of the African continent and to a limited extent within the framework of the UN, around some people, some issues which we believe really make this issue very, very crystal. And one of the key areas on which it is, a lot of this debate turns, which will be addressed next week, by the way, in during the course of the meeting of the AU, is the question of business and human rights. Now, in South Africa, as you know, we come from a perspective of putting forward two positions. One is that businesses have got primary obligations. If they do not do what they're supposed to do, this is not because they're not doing us a favor. They are in breach of our law. They have got primary obligations. That is not the framework of RUGI and the United Nations, but it is increasingly the framework of the African continent. The second point of departure we have is that when you've got assets and resources that are community resources, we place in our own legislation obligations for community consultation and community consent. And the African Commission has ruled on the fact that free prior informed consent in its Enderas decision, that that needs to be the bar that should inform the way in which the resources of this continent, the resources of our country, are used for the purposes of the people. Now, that's something that Africa has got a whole bunch to teach people who kind of deal with issues of human rights in Geneva, and I believe that that is, in fact, what a lot of the engagement has been. So it's just by way of example that I agree with you, the question of what is a community a right and an individual right, that there needs to be a proper harmonization. With regard to the question that you raise around reports, Chairperson, your committee is a committee that has a huge volume of work to deal with. We do, first of all, as you've indicated, provide our reports to the ISD's office, but we do, and I have personally been here when we have provided in our annual reports information that deal with these treaties. But that's part and parcel of a whole lot of other information. And I think, therefore, your suggestion on the workshop, in addition to any suggestions you might have about enabling us to come and present reports more frequently, because I think that will help members, you know, who've got really quite a lot of heaps of things to go through, even from the Commission, let alone from all the other responsibilities you have. That might be a way that we can bridge this, as well as your proposal on the workshop. Regarding the question of speaking rights and CGE and the Human Rights Commission and the commission that deals with culture and languages and so on, we are in complete agreement that this is something that does have to be managed. We do actually have joint consultations. For example, when it comes to the CEDAW reports with the Commission on Gender Equality, and in fact, we have encouraged that commission to be the final architect of the report, which then goes in under the banner of the Human Rights Commission as the NHRI. But we, as our chairperson, Chairperson Lawrence Mushwana has mentioned, would like as well to have a discussion with the committee together with colleagues from our other Chapter 9 institutions to look at various ways in which some of these things can be dealt with. We think that that is a conversation we'd like to have jointly as opposed to reaching any particular view as this commission. And of course, I then wanted to mention in terms of the SOGI, the gender consultation to the Honourable Member Horn, with the at the moment, a date has not been set, a final date, but it was due to take place in September of this year. I'm sure at the session that is taking place later on this month, in the coming weeks, there will be a date set, and we anticipate that the feedback that will be required will still be required this year. But originally the date was September. With regard to the issue, I think I've addressed of the question of SADC and also the issue of affordability. The extent to which our own laws are affordable is the question, rather than whether or not the protocols from Geneva are affordable. It's our own laws and their affordability which are clearly paramount. On the question, the only other issue that I did want to address was in relation to the question of the ICC and the African Court. At the moment, the African Court's obligations is to look at civil, to pronounce on civil types of disputes, not criminal. But of course, the issue of criminal remit is what is part of the discussion that is taking place in Addis Ababa as to whether or not it should be reworked. But at the moment, it does not have a mandate to investigate criminal complaints. So in that sense, our being a signatory to the ICC is the only international criminal court that we currently a part of. As you know, the SADC tribunal is suspended, so to that extent, that has not yet been fully revived, although there have been discussions about its revival. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thanks for that comprehensive response. Is there any follow-up from members? Honourable Majaki.
Thank you, Chair. It's in terms of the response to the question about speaking rights. The South African Human Rights Commission is a national human rights...
It's called a national... National Human Rights Institution as recognized by the UN. They only recognize one body.
And I think the question was around that, to say that if it's... Because we've got Chapter 9 institutions that are meant to protect human rights in South Africa. Now, if one of the Chapter 9 institutions is just the only one recognized by the United Nations, that constitutes a problem, if I understand the chairperson's question correctly. And your answer was actually saying we do consult with them when we deal with issues of gender and the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. We consult with the Commission on Gender Equality. But the question is about speaking rights, as to how you are addressing that question, seeing that it's only the South African Human Rights Commission that is a member. And then in terms of affordability, my question was not around affordability in terms of South African legislation. My question was around whether you do take into consideration, whenever you think of ratification of an instrument, the extent to which it's going to actually be affordable for South Africa, which could be a separate process altogether, where you look at something and then you actually then indicate its implication for the country, so that you know you are letters of this that the country is supposed to be entering, the kind of agreement that the country or commitment that the country will be entering into, as to whether it's something that you think will be affordable or not. And maybe it's not only about affordability. Implementation also can be a challenge. And I think as a country, we need to actually handle exercises of this nature in that way, in order for us not to come up with systems and mechanisms that are bound to create problems for the country. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just one follow-up question. It's mentioned there in the presentation that the Commission has written to the Minister regarding the regional seminar. Maybe if the Commission can give us details as to when they have written, because it's mentioned there that they have not received a response yet, so one does not want to make an adverse finding if the letter was written 2 days ago, but if it's been written 2 months ago, it's obviously another issue.
Chairperson, two things. Firstly, just to clarify, in relation to the CGE, if the CGE would want to speak, they would have to speak as, which we have given that as an opportunity. They have been to Geneva and they've spoken as the human rights institution, in other words, under our banner, but not in their own right as CGE, because the UN rules do not allow. So it's not just consulting and drawing reports together and giving them the final possibility to finalize a report, but it's also speaking. Secondly, we don't consider ratification. You do. And you are the ones who have agreed to the ratification in the case of the convention. Thirdly, with regard to the issue of the letter was written on the 7th of July. Thank you, Chairperson.
I think that we are going in the right direction. I am aware that there is a fund called Human Rights Foundation for Human Rights, and money, international funding, is channeled to the country through that fund. You yourself have a budget to promote human rights. And the other, the Gender Commission, CRL, have fund to promote this thing. So I think there's a lot of money in the country to do the work. And now it's a matter of grave concern that there is no constitutional literacy. That our people still know very little about the Constitution, and that could be a contributory factor of the point that Honorable Majaki raised, that people just feel entitled, government that must do everything for them, but they have no responsibility. And now we are going to be in conflict with the people because we assume they know what they don't know. Now, the question is, how do we actually use all these resources that are there to promote and educate people on the rights and responsibilities? And we need to have mechanisms to do that. And that's why I think maybe when we have the workshop, you could start thinking about this thing. How we could mobilize all these. I got a list from the department of the number of advice centers in the country. There are a lot. Others promote socioeconomic rights, which means they could be educating people to make demands on government, regardless of what government can afford. And my understanding of this socioeconomic rights is that they must be implemented progressively, which means taking into account what the state can afford. Because you can't go to a state like Swaziland, which depends on foreign funding, for instance, and say overnight all the rural areas must have four-roomed houses. and they must have water and electricity. It can be. I think that's the point that you correctly made, that what we do must also be consistent with our own legislation. So I think education, therefore, becomes an important matter, and what we also will be doing is to maybe have a meeting or invite reps of these advice centers in our meetings, so to hear from them what are they doing, in what direction, because you may fund them to agitate people to demand from government what government cannot afford, because they are competing priorities. We are a developing country. We are not having money in abundance. But another point that Honorable Majake made about SADC and AU, you see, Africa has lots of problems. For instance, in the past, we had the Cold War. The Cold War is over, but we may have another kind of a Cold War. You look at Nigeria, the Boko Haram situation. You look at Kenya, Al-Shabaab, Somalia. Now, you are dealing with fundamentalists who happen to be Islamic fundamentalists. And the danger may be that people think that all Islam is a problem. So if we don't educate our people, we may have a situation where there is a conflict between Islam and Christianity, because people will think Islam, all Islam is fundamental. But also, you see, even in our country, there's still a lot of intolerance. Say, for instance, the Christian, some Christian communities will say African religion is not a religion, and they wouldn't want to participate in a forum where practitioners of African religion participate. And you have to force back in Johannesburg, you find that some Christians saying that the Muslims are making noise when they call for prayer. And those are seeds of destabilization. So we should be having, you know, dialogues about these people, teaching people about religious freedom of association, of thought, expression, religion, and so on. We shouldn't assume that our people understand and accept these things. So Africa has South Africa has a chance of really influencing the rest of Africa on religious tolerance. For instance, we have an organization called National Interfaith Council of South Africa, where all religions work together. An advantage should be taken of such structures to promote peace. Now, also the consultation. I think also that we shouldn't be prioritizing running to the UN. When we are in the UN, we are seen as representing Africa. But within Africa, there's no consensus on these things. As Mr. Dengo was saying, in government itself, you find that there's no common understanding. Now, at the UN level, we are expected to be representing the country. Now, if we represent a country where there's no unanimity within the country, consensus on these things, it may also be misleading the world. Another concern also should be when we come to the point of African courts that Honorable Majake raised. You see, we come from the apartheid past. We carried over everything, the institutions and the people manning the institutions. But there's still a question of the jurisprudence. Have we transformed the jurisprudence that should apply to this court? Have we infused the new values into the institutions and the laws? Of course, you can't do that overnight. But we have a responsibility to develop a new progressive African lawyer so that the future lawyers, prosecutors, magistrates are really rooted in the new jurisprudence. Therefore, I wanted to suggest that, Honorable Majaki, when we deal with this question of the African courts, we really use this mandate to promote, to engage law students. Usually we look at law in a narrow sense. You can't fully understand the law unless you understand the society in which to which the law applies. So we need students from criminology, from social work, to be part of this thing. So I would say that our promotional work should really bring on board law students so that we produce a progressive lawyer for the future. But as far as the jurisprudence is concerned, you see, I don't know, for some reason, you know, I went to Nigeria some other time. When I get into the university or the bookshop, Nigerians write their own law books. You go to Tanzania, the Tanzanians write their own law books. But South Africa, I don't know whether it's the imbalance of the past. The only people who write law books are those who come from white universities. And black professors, whether they are in the white university or in their former homeland university, they don't produce anything. I don't know where the problem lies. So that's why I think we need to develop a progressive lawyer. We must get people who write. And writing, you don't have to be an expert. You write, you get others to edit, and so on. And the reason why we need this new writing is because we need literature on the new jurisprudence that is in line with our new constitution and this international instruments. Now, the point that Honorable Majaki raised about reporting, I think that because we can't change these arrangements overnight, but also we can't wait indefinitely for the change, if we could recommend that yourself, in terms of the, I think it's the Paris, you are a national institution, that as a national institution, you can coordinate the input by other commissions for the purpose of reporting at the national level. And you could even constitute a delegation that includes others, so that, you really, when you speak for the country, that it's one voice that is representative. Lastly, let me just say that you see, Mr. Amir Mia will remember that during the 80s, the SIDAO, the domestication of the SIDAO, was actually driven by civil society, which consulted with the office of President Nujoma in Namibia, and workshops were held. And then there was the National Children's Rights Commission, which was also driven by civil society. And now those structures which did that are still existing, but they are not supported. So these are the structures that we could go and find and see how we can empower them to enrich and support the work that we are doing. I think, in short, we really need to mobilize civil society and make sure that there's participation. As Honorable Majaki said, we want our people to own what we present in national and pan-African society. And Honorable Horn indicated that we need this workshop. We need to discuss. So I don't think we can take matters further from there. It is quite clear what we need to do. Maybe when we prepare for these workshops, we can do that in consultation with yourselves and the relevant departments, and make sure that when we meet, we have of the same mind. Honorable Horn.
Chairperson, not to belabor the point, and if the rest of the committee don't feel like me, they're free to say so. I don't know whether I misunderstood your opinion that we should, as a committee, just take note that as there is no consensus in government, our country, or Africa regarding the LGBTI issues, we should refrain from, as a body of oversight of the executive, ask the minister why he has not met his commitment to arrange for the seminar. But my proposal still is that we should at least ask the minister for the reasons why he has not met his prior commitment and has not answered the letter of 7 July, as to maybe do our job as an oversight body and see to it that the executive meet their commitments, arrange the seminar so that we as a region is able to meet our responsibilities towards the UN.
What did the letter say?
Chairperson, the letter is simply referring to the original indication given in 2011 by South Africa that it would host the African Regional Consultation, which has been made since then on the question of gender rights. And our Minister of International Relations, she in Geneva in March of this year, made that as a public statement, a confirmation. So it was in relation to that that Chairperson Mashwana wrote to the Department of International Relations to clarify what is happening on the 7th of July.
I recall that you said that such statements are binding.
Such statements, I mean, in those kind of contexts, those statements are regarded as politically binding. And so it's a question really of what will happen now is that at the end of this year, first of all the other regions have had their consultations. South Africa and Africa will not have had its consultation. I think the concern would be, even if that consultation can't happen before the end of the year, just in practical terms right now, the concern would be to make sure that you presumably understand what the problems are. But secondly, as I've indicated, the departments that have been involved in this together with the Department of International Relations, Department of Justice, the Department of Social Development, they too could maybe give some kind of input as to what would be able to be arranged by when, so that at least it's not a silence from Africa on the issue, but rather an indication of what the challenges are.
Honorable Horn, you are not out of order. Honorable Lemanjaki wants to say something.
No, it's just clarity. As to whether after the statement was made, was a letter written to you to actually indicate that this will be taking place?
Honourable Member, we were present when the statement was made by our Minister, and the statement was made not to us but to the UN system confirming to the Council. So our letter was simply saying that we're aware that the reports from other regions are going to be tabled, and our letter was really by way of asking our Minister what the plans are in regard to this. So that's what our letter was about.
I think maybe it's a matter, if you want to have a response from the committee, maybe it's a matter you should have actually alerted the committee to, because I'm thinking that justice are supposed to be here, having been made aware, so they can engage on the matter. So for now, to make a pronouncement as to what action needs to be taken might be a bit difficult. As long as we have noted what has been presented in the meeting, Chair, and there will be a way of responding to it, because we will also be meeting the Department of Justice. Is it about LGBTI, if I understand you well?
Honourable Member, yes, it is. Just to clarify, I think that the recommendation of what the committee does or doesn't do isn't really coming from us. We have indicated, we've certainly raised it and discussed it at length with the Department of Justice and with representatives of the Department of International Relations. But in relation to our giving you a presentation on some of the issues around the participation of South Africa in the United Nations Council, this is one of the issues that we're fairly sure will come up. So that's why we're briefing you on that as well. But how you decide you want to exercise, you know, your oversight or whatever role, that we leave that to you, clearly.
Yeah, no, I think that the relationships between Parliament and the Department with regard to these internationals have not been working well. So we will need to meet with our counterparts in the other portfolio committees. We will need to interact with the affected departments and really create a, you know, dynamic relationship with them to address these issues. You see, also the lack of communication with ourselves from your side is that I know when we were in the UN, when you deal with LGTB, the majority of African states take a different view, that some big powers would even say to South Africa, try and persuade your colleagues from Africa to adopt our position. But those dynamics in the UN and the reasons for African states not to support that, we don't know. So we can't engage with them. So I think that is something that we should not only say people must reply to the letter. We must create space to address that issue. What are other African countries saying? Why? What are the? What is the UN system saying? Why? Because if you impose a position on Africa on this thing, people will ignore you. So I think let's make this consultation work, and then we discuss and take our people along. Even this question of the justiciability of socio-economic rights, which is a good thing that comes from our constitution. But also you may find that the courts are imposing obligations on government which government cannot meet. There's a case now where the Supreme Court of Appeals says legal aid must pay the expenses of the Marikana victims. They want them to pay 17 million. Now, do they have the 17 million? And how many Marikanas may we have between now and the time of the next elections, 2019? That legal aid can become bankrupt. So I think that when we take decisions, we must also look at the resources of the country, that what the country can afford. Otherwise, we'll run down the country, bankrupt the state. So that's why it's important that Parliament, government, Chapter 9 institutions, we really need to dialogue and move in the same direction.
Otherwise, there's no other question.
Can
I say that I think a good start was made. I didn't realize how much important this meeting is, but I think has been a very good meeting because it gives us a way forward. So when we communicate with the parents and we have noted all the consent, I think that's just what that I make of us move forward. Thank you very much and enjoy your long time.